And welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Jim Caruso. Things are getting interesting here in the Bay Area. The teachers across the street from me are on strike for more pay, and so I'm even now being serenaded by chants of, hey, hey, ho, ho, where did all the money go?
Well, you know, it's nice to have a local issue instead of the national issues we're so tired of reading about.
Exactly. Well, Jim, our guest is Zach Cooper, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He is, of course, based in Washington, D.C., where he researches, writes, speaks, podcasts, gives interviews, acts as a talking head, does all that stuff about mostly about U.S. strategy in Asia, but against many other things, about many other things as well. Hey, Zach, have you ever thought about going down to the U.S. Capitol and picketing about where all our money goes?
It's a hopeless effort, you know, Ray. I just try not to think about it.
Well, the 2024 version of the People's Republic of China seems bolder and more confident and more aggressive and less sensitive to things like negative publicity and reputational cost than the versions that we all grew up and were used to over previous decades. It's got these gray zone operations and military exercises that seem to only be getting larger and louder and sharper edged. That old era of hide your strength and bide your time seems to be giving way now to something like flout your strength and shout your ambitions. So why should we care if today's China under Xi Jinping can't seem to be deterred?
Well, first, it's great to be with both of you and, you know, huge fan of the work you guys are doing. And I feel like I get asked this question, why should we care about any of the things we work on all the time? And so it's fun to debate this with both of you. Look, I think the big question that a lot of us have been asking for a few years, and I know both of you have done a lot of thinking about this, is to what degree can we actually change Chinese behavior? And I'm not sure that anybody has a clear answer on this. But to the extent that there's any agreement in Washington, I think the agreement is that maybe we're less confident that we can change the fundamentals of Beijing's behavior, at least at the moment, than maybe previous people were, you know, even just a few years ago, right? And I think that's true on, you know, some South China Sea issues that you guys have covered a lot. It's true on Ukraine, right? It's true probably on a whole bevy of economic issues. And so I think what we're going to see is increasingly a more and more potentially confident China, especially if growth is able to resume at some reasonable level, but also a China that may be less reflective about the mistakes that it's making. And I think that's troubling for all of us. And something that I've, you know, tried to think a little bit about, but I think it leaves us in a tough place, which is, you know, what should the goal of U.S. policy be? So should it be coercive, right, to compel changes in Chinese policy, or it should be more focused on just protecting and defending ourselves because we can't change the nature of the Chinese government's actions? And that's something, at least I struggle with a lot.
So you mentioned China reflecting on some of the errors. What are the errors that they've made in their own opinion, and how are they changing behavior?
Well, I look at the successes the United States has had in the last couple of years. You know, think about what's happened with the U.S.-India relationship, the U.S.-South Korea relationship, U.S.-Japan, U.S.-Australia, which you know way better than just about anyone, Jim. U.S.-Philippines, Ray, you know, you've been at the center of all of this. And some people say that it's because we have wonderful American diplomats. And you know, obviously that's true, Jim. You should get most of the credit. But a lot of the credit
goes to
tell
him more about himself.
I could do this all day.
You know, but a lot of the credit goes to our Chinese friends, right? And the reality is that, you know, with India, the Sino-Indian border conflict, you know, especially what happened first at Doklam, then elsewhere in the River Valley, you know, clearly shifted Indian activities. In Japan, this went back to 2010 and 2012 over the Senkakus. I'd say, you know, with Korea, this is probably dated since 2017, since the THAAD debacle and the Chinese overstepping on THAAD. On Australia, again, Jim, you know, the economic pressure that the Australians faced from China for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. On the Philippines, I'd say the pressure on the Spratlys. And then you could throw in Taiwan and others, right? And I think in each of those cases, Chinese pressure has backfired dramatically and opened the door for the US. And smart policymakers have been able to walk through that door. And I don't want to suggest that that's easy to do. But, you know, I think in all of those cases, Beijing has made some mistakes. And I would throw in Ukraine. I think they've made some pretty dramatic mistakes in how they've handled Europe, right? We were talking just a few years ago about a comprehensive investment agreement. And no, that's gone, right? And yes, they're trying to reengage with the Europeans, but it is tough. So I think there's a whole range of countries where the Chinese have overstepped and where I actually haven't seen a major readjustment in policy in most of those locations.
Well, we do seem to see a couple of adjustments of sorts, right? So there has been kind of a strange settlement around the second Thomas Scholl issue for now, where apparently the resupply missions are going through uncontested, and both the Philippines and China seem to have different narratives about why that is, but it seems to happen anyway. And of course, we've just had this looks like a settlement on the border with India. So are they actually starting to decide that they need to kind of tamp a few of these things down?
I think this is a fascinating question, right? Because if you went back, let's say 10 years, most China scholars would say that China typically did not want to be facing multiple crises at the same time. And so, yeah, if the South China Sea was a little hot, then the East China Sea and Taiwan Strait would be calmer and, you know, on down the line. I think now what we've seen is actually a pretty high willingness to tolerate discord in a bunch of different areas all at the same time. But look, maybe the Sino-Indian border agreement that they've just announced is the beginning of some improvement of ties. Ray, I think you're not going to agree with this, but theoretically, the Chinese and the Philippines could come to some sort of arrangement beyond Second Thomas Scholl that would calm things down. You know, I think they've tried to maybe soften the approach to Australia in the last year. So yes, we're seeing a bit of a shift, but I still don't think it's necessarily because leaders in Beijing feel like they made a mistake. I get the sense that it's more of a tactical change rather than a strategic one.
So my concern about that is Xi finally prioritizing Taiwan well and truly? Because clearly he's ratcheted up the pressure there big time, even as he's moderated some activities into the south, although I note that the welcome to Prabowo as president of Indonesia was to send some Chinese Coast Guard vessels in the Tuna Sea. But overall, my concern is he quieting things to the south a bit to focus on Taiwan, which is clearly his priority?
I completely agree, Jim, that, you know, Taiwan appears to be the priority, right? And I think that makes sense from a domestic standpoint. Clearly, Taiwan is more important to the party than the Sino-Indian border, or frankly, than, you know, a trade spat with Australia, or, you know, a spat over K-pop and the roots of where, you know, kimchi comes from with the Koreans. You know, these things are pretty obvious sideshows. They may have done a lot of damage in those countries, but Taiwan, I think, is clearly the most important. So, yeah, I think that that's something we should be watching quite closely. And the Chinese response to the National Day speech that Lai Ching-te gave in Taipei, I think, should be concerning for all of us, not just because it's an escalation, but also because it's setting the tone for what China might do in the future if there are additional cross-strait tensions. And let's be honest, they're going to be.
So I assume you're referring here to the joint sword exercises that they just conducted around Taiwan, which looked a lot like a blockade or at least a quarantine of the island. Do you think, though, that President Lai's speech, do you think that was, how much do you think that caused that level of exercise? And how much do you think it was just pretext saying, well, we want to do this anyway, and you've given us our excuse?
Boy, it's a good question. I mean, I guess this goes into the issue of what the Chinese really think about Lai. And my interactions with them suggest that they really think that Lai is, you know, irresponsible and dangerous, and they have to bring him to heel. And they have a very negative view of Lai. What's interesting, of course, is that if you talk to the Taiwan officials who were involved in writing the National Day speech, they did not think that that was an escalatory speech at all, right? In fact, they intentionally thought it was domestically focused, and they thought they said some things the Chinese would have wanted to hear. Incidentally, they did this also in the other two major speeches that Lai Ching-te has given on January 13th, when he won his electoral victory, and on May 20th, when he was inaugurated. And so I think what we're seeing here is a little bit of talking past each other from Beijing and Taipei. And on this point, I do blame the Chinese, right? They had an opportunity for 8 years to engage with Tsai Ing-wen. And other than some limited back channels, there really wasn't a lot of direct engagement. And if the Chinese had been directly engaging, maybe they would have a little bit of a better understanding of what's going on within the DPP and with Lai Ching-te. But that lack of engagement is going to make it more likely that there are going to be miscommunications. And so I'm guessing that if you were able to sit down with Chinese officials, they would genuinely say that they think that what Lai Ching just said in his National Day speech was escalatory and that they had to respond. But I think what they should be doing is sitting down and trying to have a better understanding of what's actually happening in Taiwan. And that should mean actually having cross-strait discussions, right? And that's something that they decided not to do and that they have shut down. And so we should be putting pressure on them to reopen those discussions. They're not going to solve anything. But again, I think better for them to be hearing from the Taiwanese what they're thinking and hearing on Taiwan than for them to just be reading about it first when they read Lai Ching-te's speech.
All right, so then the bottom line is, can Xi, China, be deterred from taking some sort of action against Taiwan? That's why we're all here.
Yeah.
Is there anything that will deter him, in your opinion?
That's like the $6.4 trillion question right there, right?
Right.
Boy, it's a tough question, and I will be honest, I don't think I know the answer. I hope the answer is yes. I'm not a big believer in this argument that Xi Jinping has some timeline that he's going to adhere to regardless of how confident he is that he can accomplish an invasion. You know, I think if he thinks that he can do an invasion and that the U.S. won't respond and Taiwan won't be able to respond, then maybe he would do it tomorrow, right? If we can convince him that the cost of trying to conduct a major military operation against Taiwan are too high, or that ultimately that operation will be unsuccessful, then I think the odds of him attempting it are actually pretty low. So I may be a little bit more confident that deterrence can be bolstered significantly in the near term to maintain deterrence as a strategy over the medium term, maybe even the long term. But I think the question you're asking is a tough one because it goes to whether Xi Jinping really thinks that he has to have what the Chinese would call reunification.
So just to follow up, I was reading today by one Taiwan expert that the key is to make economic pain to senior Chinese government officials. So freeze their assets or threaten to freeze their assets abroad, no more trade. So there would be real economic cost. Now, that hasn't worked very well in Russia, but China's a much more connected entrepreneurial place. What's your view of that?
I'm highly skeptical of that. And I should say, I'm not skeptical of sanctions and economic tools. That I worked a fair amount on that at the White House and helped write a book on it. I think economic tools can be effective at very specific objectives. I think changing Xi Jinping's mind about whether to invade Taiwan or not, he's accepting huge amounts of economic cost if he's decided to do this. And, you know, the wealth that senior party officials have is tremendous. I'm sure they would like to be able to travel abroad and, you know, go to the French Riviera and to, you know, beautiful islands in the Indian Ocean or the Pacific. And it's going to be a bummer for them if they only have to go to Hainan and other places of that sort. Is that going to change their decision on invasion of Taiwan? I just don't see it. And it's a little bit like Hong Kong, right? you know, people said, oh, Xi Jinping won't do this to Hong Kong because the costs on Hong Kong are too great and he won't want to bear those costs. Yeah, you know what? If this is important to the party is probably going to bear pretty high costs. Now, at the margin, does having higher economic costs help? Maybe, but I would not want to bet my deterrence strategy on economic costs, which is where I'm a bit skeptical of our friends in the Biden administration and their strategy of integrated deterrence, because I actually think this just comes back to the good old deterrence concept, which is basically either we can deter by punishment. I'm not sure that economic punishment's the way to go. I think, you know, military punishment is also required, or we're going to have to deter by denial, which means we have to be able to stop the military invasion from actually succeeding. And that's where my focus would be.
Okay, so you've kind of zoned us out to the broad question of deterrence. And deterrence is a term that I felt like I understood pretty well when I was, you know, growing up as a child of the Cold War. We knew kind of, you know, we wanted to deter Russia from launching nuclear missiles or rolling across the Volga Gap. And then we went into a long period of time when nobody talked about deterrence because, well, for a while, there didn't seem to be anybody to deter. And now we sort of are trying, it seems like, to re-understand what we mean by deterrence vis-a-vis this great power competition, possibly looking at a great power conflict, right? And you brought up the term integrated deterrence. And so, of course, this has come out as a way to describe the fact that there are other tools, instruments of national power, as we say, that besides the military instrument that can be used to affect the deterrence of a great power to go to war. What is deterrence in a 2024 sense as it applies to a country like China? What are we talking about? And is integrated deterrence, is that just going to be a flash in the pan, something we talked about because we were trying to get everybody on the same sheet of music and it didn't really work? Or is that something that's got some endurance to it?
I don't think integrated deterrence has endurance because I don't think there was anything fundamentally theoretically new in it. You know, I teach a class on the underlying dynamics of US-China competition and we spend a couple of weeks on deterrence. So I think a fair amount about how deterrence theory applies on US-China dynamics. And I've never heard
anyone... Zach, before you go on, just if you could very quickly talk about what is the theory or what is integrated deterrence as at least this administration has tried to define it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So look, integrated deterrence as this administration has discussed it is sort of the idea that in the past we haven't been using all of the tools at our discretion to deter. Now, I just don't think this is accurate, right? So we use tools in terms of horizontal escalation, which means that we escalate not in the same area that our opponent has escalated, but in other areas. So it could be other geographic areas or other domains, right? Other domains, like you could use economic sanctions against a Russian invasion of Ukraine. We tried that. Did it stop the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Nope. We threatened it very clearly, but it didn't work. Now, we've done other things, right? We've tried to put diplomatic costs on Russia for its invasion. Has that worked? No. Has it harmed Russia to some degree? Sure. But I think the basic logic of integrated deterrence was that we didn't need to rely so much on the military. We had these other tools, and the United States had other advantages economically and diplomatically, and we should rely more on those tools to deter and less on the military. And I think what Russia showed is that actually that failed in Ukraine. And so I'm not confident, therefore, that it would succeed any better with China. And oh, by the way, China is probably less responsive to US economic costs than Russia and has the ability to push back harder against the US, both economically, but also on the diplomatic side. So if the logic is that we're going to be able to stop China from doing something by escalating horizontally in other areas, not by escalating at the point at which the Chinese are escalating and adding additional risk to the choice that they're making, say, in the Taiwan Strait, I think that's unlikely to work. So what does vertical escalation mean in that sense? well, you know, as you know better than anyone, Ray, could mean like just accepting a lot of risk on the military side, right? Which the Philippines has been working through in a pretty difficult series of events the last year. So in the Taiwan Strait, that means that the U.S. would have to demonstrate a willingness to accept a risk of escalation, conventional escalation. I mean, we don't want to talk about it, but potentially nuclear escalation. Those are the kinds of choices that I think are more likely to deter. And here people talk about this in two different ways. Deterrence by denial, which is preventing your opponent from actually obtaining its objectives, right? So telling China that you may try and do an amphibious invasion of Taiwan, but we're going to sink the amphibious vessels that are going to carry your 400,000 strong invasion fleet, and therefore the invasion will fail. Or deterrence by punishment, which would mean threatening tremendous harm on China, nuclear attacks on Beijing, or economic blockade of China. I think the problem with those latter options is that they're less believable. It's going to be hard to convince Xi Jinping that we're going to do nuclear attacks on Beijing or even substantial conventional bombing against the Chinese mainland. That is something that he's unwilling to accept. And the economic harm we could put on China, it might harm China, but it probably wouldn't harm the senior leadership that much. And it would take a long time to take effect. And so that just drives me back to the thinking that we're in the good old deterrence world of trying to prevent, like we did, as you mentioned, you know, the Soviets from running through the Fulda Gap. And that's the military problem we should be focused on. And in this case, it's trying to make sure that the Chinese can't take or effectively coerce Taiwan through military force.
And we've all been part of games and think tank discussions about what all this would look like and what the outcome would be, and get a lot of different answers. But what strikes me is most likely, as evidenced by the recent Chinese exercise, is a quarantine of Taiwan of some sort to choke them economically without having to really fire a shot. Which of course puts us and our partners in the situation of do we fire the first shot? Do you think that scenario would have any political backing from other countries in the region?
Boy, I couldn't agree more, Jim. This is the scenario that really worries me. I think it's the one that's the hardest for us to judge politically what a U.S. administration would do. You know, if the Chinese do an invasion, and let's say they attack U.S. forces outright, you know, that means going after Okinawa, maybe Guam, U.S. military forces in the region, whether aircraft carriers, surface ships, you know, other basing. That sort of ties the hands of the American leader. There's no way I can imagine American president not responding to that. If the Chinese do a blockade and they don't really go after American forces at all, but they just focus it on Taiwan, I think it puts an American administration in a very hard position, right? Where we don't want to fire the first shot. Maybe you end up trying to run the blockade, but you know, is that a doable thing? Can we provide the supplies that Taiwan needs for however long that blockade would last? I don't know. It's a pretty hard challenge. And so I think politically, that's a real issue that American leaders would have a difficult time dealing with. And then on the military side, this is where the Chinese have this huge advantage from having just churned out a giant Navy in the last decade, which is basically the size of our legacy force. And so they are putting huge numbers of not just Navy ships out there, but Coast Guard ships, maritime militia, and they have a lot of escalation options on the blockade side. And, you know, as Ray, you've tracked better than anyone, they can use maritime militia, traditional fishing ships, Coast Guard in ways that give them some asymmetric leverage and that make our choices really difficult. And so I think that blockade option is incredibly hard for us to respond to. And making it even worse is, you know, the Chinese could announce a blockade for 2 weeks or a quarantine. I'm sure they wouldn't call it a blockade, right? They'd probably call it an inspection regime or something of that sort. Announce that it's going for 2 weeks, And if we break it, they can just end it at 2 weeks. And if we don't break it, then they keep it going after 2 weeks. So they actually have a lot of ways to escalate further or to de-escalate on their own terms. And I think that puts us in an incredibly difficult position. So I worry a lot about that blockade scenario, Jim, and also about outlying island seizure, which I know some others don't think is that likely, but I think is still a possibility we should be watching out for.
So beyond Taiwan, of course, we're seeing Chinese aggression across a lot of different geographical regions and a lot of different domains, whether it be the cyber domain, the maritime domain, whether it be, just territorial aggression in weird places, you know, out of the way places like Nepal and Bhutan. We see a lot of different kinds of Chinese aggression. And of course, we would like them not to do that. And deterrence seems like a correct, grammatically correct word to describe what we'd like to do is we'd like to deter them from doing that. But is it helpful to think of those problems that, you know, trying to check their aggression as a deterrence problem, or would you like a different word?
No, I think deterrence is the right framing. And here maybe I would say there's a differentiation, right, between what people sometimes call general deterrence and immediate deterrence. General deterrence would be if you can successfully convince your opponent not to even think of challenging the deterrence framework that exists, that would be ideal, right? If that fails and the Chinese decide that they want to actually take an action, then you're in a world that we would sometimes call immediate deterrence, where you actually have to up the ante, right? And I think we've seen this in the South China Sea, where the US's its desire would be general deterrence would hold, but clearly it's not holding everywhere. And then your fallback is to take additional actions to make sure that in the immediate cases that we're worrying about, that we can deter. But I think deterrence is the right framing that we should have for those scenarios.
So a concern I have, aside from all the ones you've already discussed, is that we go into a world of real politic on steroids, where deals are cut. You know, hey, we recognize there's only one China, that's yours, okay. But for us to stand aside, we want X. Is that a scenario you think could play out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've seen this with the Philippines, right? We'll not push you off of a shoal, but you need to stop oil and gas exploration, or you need to allow us to do oil and gas exploration in your own exclusive economic zone, right? We've seen this with Malaysia. Just since Prabowo got into office, the Chinese have already been taking actions around the Natunas that I think are along these lines. So I do think that's sort of what the Chinese have on offer. And I think the challenge we're going to have, and again, you guys know this better than I do, is some of our allies and partners in the region, because they have more limited capabilities than the Chinese, they're going to take those deals at times, either because it's politically important and they're politically vulnerable, or they think it's not a bad deal, or they just can't come up with a better solution. And so I do think the Chinese are going to make these side agreements. And, you know, at times I worry that that's going to put us in a difficult position. I think on the Philippines, for example, right, you know, the Philippines made this deal on Second Thomas Shoal. I'm not convinced that deal is going to hold forever. But at the same time, maybe the deal is good enough for now to kind of calm things down. And, you know, the U.S. isn't the one making that decision. It's a decision that Manila's made with its own interests in mind. So I think the hard part for the U.S. is we're going to want to stand for principle a lot of the time, but our allies and partners may want to make the best deal they can to lower the temperature, especially when their top trade partner, which is the truth for almost everybody in the region, is China. And so I think we're just going to have to get used to that reality, unfortunately.
So, Zach, you and I first met in person in Sydney, and you came to Sydney to run something of a simulation where we basically went through, you know, several decades, I think out to about 2050 or so, of events and responses, and we were all divided into teams. I think I was on the India team. In fact, one of our previous guests, Charlie Adele, was on the China team, and I believe that he and I went nose to nose on a couple of things that we enjoy talking about to this day. But in that simulation, something that happened was that the relative power of larger population countries, India and Indonesia, and of course China, went up, while those populations that were declining, like Australia and Japan, that their relative power was sort of decreasing throughout the decades. And interestingly, the Japan team during your simulation decided to go nuclear as a means of self-defense. So this brings us to a discussion we recently had on another podcast with General Inman Chum, in which we discussed whether or not South Korea might also consider going nuclear. And he had to admit that that's in the realm of possibility. So in an environment where deterrence maybe seems to be kind of unraveling a little bit, what is the possibility that the whole non-proliferation regime that has mostly held up ever since, you know, the 50s, that begins to crumble as countries begin to make business decisions?
Boy, Ray, I think this is the big issue that people are not paying enough attention to. And, I just had a similar discussion with Imam Chang about this a few weeks ago. I think the reality is we're going to be in a world where South Korea and Japan are talking about nuclear capabilities, either shared with the United States, right? Some sort of dual key option like what has existed in Europe, or potentially independent nuclear capabilities over the next decade or two. And the reason is, in my mind, sort of threefold. Number one is that they live in a world where North Korea has now a robust nuclear capability, right? Maybe 100 nuclear weapons, warheads. China and Russia are both building up. China is building up extremely rapidly, and the Russians are making explicit nuclear threats. Okay, so that's the threat side has gone up. At the same time, what's happened on the deterrence side? Well, it's not clear, right? You know, the United States has talked at some times about sort of withdrawing from South Korea at the very least, not necessarily withdrawing from Japan, but the Japanese certainly have their own concerns. So there's less political confidence across the South Korean public, and I think slowly over time, potentially also in Japan, about the viability of the U.S. nuclear deterrent and the extended deterrent that applies to Japan and South Korea. So that's the second factor. And then the third is just that the world looks more dangerous now than it did a few years ago, right? Ukraine really scared a lot of people in East Asia. The Japanese prime ministers, both the current one and the previous one, have both made this comment that Ukraine today could be Taiwan tomorrow. And that fear, I think, has grown. And so I think those three factors mean that we are in a world in which deterrence is eroding, including on the nuclear side. And our allies may be considering, I mean, in South Korea, they're sort of openly considering this, but I mean, our allies may be acquiring some sort of nuclear capabilities on their own or with us in some sort of shared nuclear arrangement over the next 5 to 10 years. And just to come back to where you started, Ray, I think the games that I've done, and you know, we've done a lot in Asia over the last couple of decades, there's one American tendency that holds through almost every American team, which is we have a bias, like most established great powers, to just seek a return to the status quo ante, to put our heads in the sand and say, oh, we don't want nuclear proliferation. Let's just hope this goes away. I think this is an area where actually some proactive policymaking is needed, right? These countries, our allies, are worried about extended deterrence for a reason. Just trying to reassure them, the Biden team tried to do this with the Washington Declaration in South Korea, and it hasn't really worked. And so I think we're going to have to think really differently about this in the coming years. And it's troubling. And I'm not one of those people who thinks that rapid global nuclear proliferation is stabilizing. But I think we've got to be ready for a world in which we're talking about, you know, a significantly larger number of nuclear states. And that could be true both in Northeast Asia. It could be true in the Middle East and potentially elsewhere too.
Do you think this could be true in Taiwan?
I think it's unlikely. As you will know, you know, the Taiwanese did have a nuclear program. We stopped it. Same thing is true with a lot of our friends, including with Korea during the Cold War. And look, the Chinese have been extremely clear that that's basically one of their red lines. And it would be hard for me to imagine that Taiwan could get anywhere close to a real nuclear deterrent capability with a secure second strike without the Chinese knowing way in advance. And so I don't think that's a risk that Taiwan is likely to take. And I think the Chinese would be very, very clear with Taipei about the potential risks of going down that path. But that then puts more pressure on us to make sure that we understand exactly what our approach is. If we have a high degree of proliferation in Northeast Asia and Taiwan is sort of the one player without an explicit extended deterrence guarantee or its own nuclear weapons, that is going to make us have to think, I think, a lot harder about exactly how we posture on the nuclear side for a Taiwan Strait contingency.
Yeah, and so that sort of brings up the question is, what lesson do you think that countries who watched what happened to Ukraine, which of course had nuclear weapons and willingly gave them up based on some assurances that we made back in 1994, what, you know, I mean, this may be a bit of a leading question, but what lessons about this question do you think that they took from that example?
I think the lesson is better to have an independent capability than one that's entirely reliant on the United States. Now, can we convince our friends that, yes, they might like an independent capability, but that violating the NPT and the sanctions that comes along with this isn't worth it? Perhaps. And maybe that's how we end up with some sort of shared nuclear option, right, where you have a dual key system and the U.S. retains some degree of control over those nuclear weapons. That, from an American standpoint, is probably preferable to our allies having fully independent nuclear capabilities in East Asia. But my view is that that's probably the road we're leading down. And look, not to get political here, because I think this is going to happen regardless of who wins the U.S. election. But I think we do have to be honest that the South Koreans are particularly worried about a Trump presidency, because Trump has been explicit that he is not so interested in having American ground forces in South Korea. And I think he also might be perfectly willing to talk about nuclear sharing options with the South Koreans and see actually the provision of some U.S. nuclear reassurance options to South Korea, even nuclear sharing or an independent South Korean nuclear capability, as preferable to a large conventional American force remaining on the peninsula. So I think this is likely to accelerate if Trump wins, but even if Harris wins, this debate will be ongoing. And I think it'll be ongoing, not just in Seoul, but increasingly in Tokyo and who knows, you know, maybe in Canberra as well.
Well, and just to reflect back on our discussion with General Chun, I believe in episode 34, he said, not only did he sort of kind of endorse that idea, he said, why not let us pay for it? And one would think that might appeal very much to a certain possible potential future president.
Yeah. And look, like, I don't think this is a crazy view by the South Koreans. Some people treat it as such, but their primary threat is North Korea. The North Koreans are now in a full-on treaty alliance where they're providing thousands and thousands of troops to a Russian war. The Russians are making nuclear threats and the Chinese are engaged in the largest nuclear buildup or the fastest nuclear buildup perhaps in history. And at the same time, the South Koreans have real serious questions about the continued U.S. presence on the peninsula. I mean, if I were sitting in Seoul, I'd probably be asking questions about nuclear options also. So I think it's entirely rational given the world that we're living in today. And so Americans, we can't just have the status quo approach and think, oh, this will go away. I think we have to be a bit more proactive in thinking about how to deal with this in a forward-looking way that is, you know, sustainable over the long term.
So what does that look like? I mean, the non-proliferation treaty was violated by India and Pakistan. They paid virtually no price for violating the treaty. So if I'm South Korea and Japan, allies of the U.S., maybe they feel pretty good about that possibility of not suffering a downside.
Yeah, I think there are clearly downsides, as you know, and you know they're probably mostly economic and diplomatic. I think if you're South Korea and Japan, it's probably optimal for the U.S. to introduce nuclear weapons in a nuclear sharing way rather than to pursue an independent nuclear capability and all the investments that would be required for, you know, not just the nuclear systems, but the targeting infrastructure, the command and control requirements, the redundancy requirements. And oh, by the way, all of that just to have a less redundant, less secure nuclear response capability than the U.S. already has. So I think ideally, if we're forward-leaning, we can convince them not to develop their own independent capabilities. But let's be honest, if they think the U.S. isn't going to be there at the end of the day, and therefore that those U.S. nuclear guarantees are essentially not worth the paper they're written on, then those reassurances may not work, and they may want to have independent capabilities all on their own. But I think a lot of effort right now should be going into trying to convince them that if they are definitely going down this path, there's a way to do it with us that incurs fewer costs and has more benefits, and in which the U.S. alliances with both of those two countries stay strong. And let me be clear, I don't think the Japanese are quite ready for this discussion. You know, the new prime minister is having some debates about this, but the Japanese public is not where the South Korean public is. But the debate in Seoul is really different and has shifted remarkably over the last few years.
All right. So exit question. You just mentioned the new Japanese prime minister. Asian NATO, go.
So I've been quoted a little bit in Japanese press on this. So I've been a critic. I've been a critic long before, the new prime minister Shiba said this. Look, the problem with thinking about an Asian NATO in my mind is three fundamental differences with NATO. And you sort of brought this up right at the beginning. So what was NATO at the beginning? Well, when NATO was stood up, basically it was a bunch of capitalist countries who were opposing communist countries. It was a bunch of democratically elected governments who were opposing autocratic governments. And oh, by the way, all of them were most worried about one contingency, an invasion of the inner German border through the Fulda Gap that would imperil all of Western Europe. That was the worry. So these countries were so unified about what they were worried about and about, frankly, their own form of government and economic systems and on down the line. In Asia, a lot of our friends aren't democratic. Some of them aren't capitalist. I mean, they're kind of capitalist, but not entirely. And none of them share the same concern about a unifying threat. They might be worried about China, but as you both know, the South Koreans are worried about primarily North Korea. Japanese are probably most worried about East China Sea. Taiwan is most worried about the Taiwan Strait. Vietnam's most worried about the Paracels. Philippines is most worried about the Spratlys. Malaysia is not worried about anything, even though they should be. The Indonesians are slightly worried about the Tuna Islands. Australia is worried about economic coercion. India is worried about the Sino-Indian border. There's no unifying contingency that brings them all together. And I don't think, therefore, that the idea of an Asian NATO is possible because all of these countries have a huge incentive to essentially allow the others to take the brunt of the first attack, right? So in academic parlance, we would say this is buck passing, whereas in the NATO context, you had to chain gang everybody together because if the Soviets got through the inner German border, there was no stopping them from going into Italy and France and eventually on down the line into the Iberian Peninsula, et cetera, et cetera. That's just not the case in Asia. So I don't think for theoretical reasons an Asian NATO is possible. But if what Prime Minister Shiba is saying is that actually we should be tying our allies and partners together more tightly, sure. I think we've seen elements of that through the Quad. We've seen, you know, technology cooperation through AUKUS. So I think we're seeing real cooperation that hadn't existed previously that's important and good, but I don't think it's going to look anything like an Asian version of NATO.
All right. Well, if you enjoyed that, you can get your share, your fill of Zach Cooper as one of the co-hosts on the second best geopolitical podcast you can find out there, Net Assessment. But Zach, where else should people be following you and your work?
Let's see. You know, you can always go on our website at the American Enterprise Institute, and they've got some of the stuff up there. And then eventually here in February, I'll have a book coming out on the rise and fall of great military. So yeah, looking forward to getting a chance to talk about that when it's out after way too long on my part.
All right. Well, speaking of way too long, it's been way too long since we've seen each other. So it's been good to see you again. So, Jim, first of all, Zach is great. I love talking to Zach. He's just so interesting. And by the way, if people aren't listening to Net Assessment, you should be. I will say they take on the world. So it's not just an Indo-Pacific podcast. They go all over the world. But it's always engaging. It's always interesting that Zach and his two co-hosts have a great rapport and banter. So I always get something out of it. So, yeah, Zach's gone, But I honestly really like that one. We got deep into this discussion about deterrence, which may seem a little bit, you know, like the study of international relations students here at Stanford or something. And yet it feels like we probably need to learn to rediscover how to talk about it a whole heck of a lot more.
Well, if you look at it from the big picture, from the time we and the Soviets both got nukes, deterrence has worked in that the two major powers have never gone to war with each other directly. Is it breaking down, I guess, is the question.
Yeah.
Because of our commitments to our allies and China's stated absolute requirement to take Taiwan, despite the fact we say we guarantee Taiwan will not be reunited except under mutual agreement. How do you deter what seems to be an immovable object in that sort of fuzzy principle area of they're both the same country? We say they're both the same country. And you can see that in our politics sometimes reflected that confusion and uncertainty.
And we didn't bring this term up, but there's another term that gets thrown around a lot, and that's this idea of a country that has achieved, quote, escalation dominance. And to some degree, China in many ways seems to believe that it does have that or act as if it has that, or just the idea that we are willing to go farther than you are. And so if you want to stay on this train, you've bought the ticket to ride because we are taking it all the way to the end of the tracks. What they tend to seem to believe is, and with some good evidence, is that the other party will jump off eventually.
And which is why nuclear proliferation is such a hot topic now.
Yeah. And again, and we were, as we're recording this, we're still in the election season, and we every second or third podcast, we grouse about the fact that these things don't come up, even though they're so important to the future of our own country. One question I wanted to ask Zach, and I just ran out of time, was, you know, if you were a moderator for a presidential debate, what question would you want to ask the candidates? Honestly, this whole entire topic of what deters great power conflict, what deters, you know, China in 2024. I would love to sort of hear the discussion, although I'm not entirely confident it would be very edifying, given the state of our politics.
It can't compare with discussing whether transgender athletes should compete.
Or golf games.
Or golf games, yes. Well, that's, yeah. We won't go there. We're very polite.
So, okay. Well, Jim, you need to tell me a story. So I am all ears. Tell me something that's going to make my day.
I don't know if it'll make your day, but it's talking to Zach about two nations fighting over the same piece of territory that they both say is theirs. Reminds me of my time in Cyprus, which is Greek and Turkish, divided in half since the 1974 invasion by the country of Turkey, cutting the country in half. So the northern part of Cyprus is now supposedly independent, recognized only by Turkey. But there still remains some Greeks who live there, especially in this one little village in the far northeast of the country. So your intrepid diplomat went up there to see how they're being treated and how they feel about life. And when I got there, it's this frozen amber little village from the time of the invasion, 1974. Yeah, they have color TV now. That's sort of about it. And all the young men, actually all the men in general, have gone to the south. But the women, the older women, for whatever reason, have stayed. So I go in there and I speak some Greek. So I'm speaking to them in Greek. They haven't seen a lot of men in a while. And they kept stroking my arm and calling me dearie and trying to feed me. And I said, well, thanks, you know, I'm actually American. Yes, 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 but you're Greek. But they were very careful.
And so you went back once a week, right?
Well, the food was good, but it was really, and I kept trying to say, how are the Turks treating you? And of course, they were very careful, even though there was no one there from the government, but they didn't want to cause any trouble for anybody. But, you know, there are human consequences to these things.
And remind me, because I don't know how far back you and Elizabeth go, but were you single at the time?
These were women considerably older than me, first of all. Second of all, yes, we were married still.
Oh, okay.
Already.
I was curious if we were looking at a big fat Greek wedding scenario. So.
All
right. Well, all right. Well, from that very not Indo-Pacific story, we want to wrap up this edition of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, and thank our producer, Ian Ellis Jones. Please keep following him on @IanEllisJones on X. And of course, if you enjoyed our podcast, make sure you subscribe and like and leave a nice review for us on youtube.com @IP Podcast. Let me try that again, youtube.com/IP Podcast. And then, of course, if you like to listen to us on audio podcasts, just go to your favorite audio podcast service, whether it be Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Amazon or wherever you listen to us, and like and subscribe and give us nice reviews. If you want to hear more, please look back at some of our older podcasts. I mentioned the one, of course, during the course of the podcast, such as the one on Korea that we did recently with General In Bun Chung. But also we had the one with Charlie Adele that I talked about. And let's go all the way back to episode 7, one of our most popular podcasts with Mick Ryan and Mike Studeman, Why Should We Care About the Defense of Taiwan? That was a really great one. Please like us on X, follow us on LinkedIn. However you follow us, however you listen to us, thanks for joining us. And we'll talk again soon on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.